As we evolve as a digital institution or a digital organization, our processes need to be rethinked. A lot of times, and I see it very often, a lot of times we take something which is new and we try to make it fit something that is old. And it takes guts, right, from the executive team to say, you know what, the processes we had are actually archaic, or they're actually not fit for digital momentum, right? And instead of maintaining and try to force fit a digital design to fit an archaic process, we actually change the process. And it takes a lot of guts, right? Because process and change management is complex.
Welcome back. In this episode, we speak with Diomedes Castanis, the Chief Technology Officer in the Asia-Pacific region for Microsoft. He's a tall, energetic, and charismatic man with an infectious belief in the power of innovation. We met on a balmy day in Singapore at a beautiful outdoor cafe under some massive tropical trees and shared a wonderful breakfast. Now, during our far-reaching conversation about the challenges to digital adoption, Diomedes discusses the importance of the user interface, or the UI, in the mass adoption of digital technology and touches on the applications of AI to knowledge management. Also discusses the necessity for integrating domain-specific expertise with technological advancements. I think these are all great themes. We do get into some terms that are complex, but I try to explain as we go along to the best of my ability. I have to warn you that I learned about what not to do when interviewing people on this trip. And one of them is to not set up meetings in crowded cafes, unless you have the right technology and equipment, which sadly at the time I did not. So please excuse the background noise and instead maybe use it to put yourself in Singapore with us on a lovely, slightly overcast late morning on an outside patio.
I think in general, every mass adoption of digital technology, if you go back, it has always been because of the user interface. If you think about 1995 was the era of the PC, the user interface was that Windows UX PC sort of type of interface, right? 2005, we moved to Touch UX. Touch UX what really made a difference in adoption, right? Mass adoption of the cellular device, right? Even at not an affordable cost, right? Just because it was easy for us to utilize, right? So we went from this 90 UX adoption through the PC UX to Touch UX. And for the first time now, we see voice UX, right? Becoming that user interface that really becomes a catalyst, right? Of mass adoption on digital services. And that's why you saw ChatGPT 3 weeks, 100 million users, never been done before, right? If you look at Facebook, if you look at every other success, TikTok or whatever, right? They all took longer. Just because that path of resistance of digital technology has been demystified. It has been easy for everyone to use. Everybody can use language. Everybody can use their finger. And it has been so much easier, right? That user interface, like you put it, right? Last mile. Last mile in technology is user interface. A natural language could be not a language, right? It could be gestures. It could be video. My whole point is that Steve Jobs said it the best. The best pointing device is your finger. And the best communicating device is you, right? Whether it's through your voice, through your gestures, through whatever, right? I think when you start thinking the human as the conduit to communication, that changes everything. And I think the gap has always been the last mile, to your point, yeah. Right? It has never been easy for a human to communicate with a device at a degree of accuracy, right, that is currently being done. So now we are reaching that inflection point, right, where technology capability and human capability comes together. There is no better way to describe. Professor Venkat at Boston University always used to tell me, right? It takes an intelligent machine and an intelligent person to come together to create amazing. The human race has evolved from an academic, educational perspective, right? So the talent is better, right? So you got better talent, you got better technology, that's perfect storm. So we are in this first phase where the manifestation of that user interface is a lot more protrusive. So you have to talk, with all these data signals, like all these ML models or large language models, large market are taking, a lot of the things will be done automatically, ambiently. You will not have to indicate that, oh, I want to play music, right? Just because it knows you are in that mood, it knows your heartbeat, it knows that you are in that state that you want to play music and that will happen. I think we're getting there in that totality of computer interaction.
So Diomedes raises a very interesting point. technology adoption is predicated on creating and leveraging a user interface that humans can use and use effectively. He also made the interesting point that the interface need not be limited to voice or touch, but can also include gestures or actions. Very cool. Next, I asked what and how would digital truly interface with healthcare? What was holding us up?
Okay, so I don't know if that is technology per se, but I would say the first fundamental shift I believe we'll have in the medicine is the mindset. And maybe it sounds a little bit boring or something, but I think when domain experts get access to engineering resources, they get a new lens of thinking. Yes. So it's very different to have a doctor that has never been exposed to digital complexity to allow him to shape his thinking in a digital way. What I tend to say, a perfect doctor for me is an engineer doctor, a guy who actually tries to engineer the problem using the domain knowledge and applying those multiple lenses, right, to the problem to solve it, right? It's the same, like a good computer scientist is a guy who understands how a CPU works, how memory works, how I/O works, how assembly works, how computer language works, and interface works, only because he can root cause. What I'm saying, this triangulation of engineering and domain knowledge, in this particular case, medicine, for me is the beautiful thing because it just gives you more firepower, right, in the thought process.
Love it.
And that goes to my second point. Thinking is the first, and the way to manifestate thinking adoption is simulation. Never before you had the ability to simulate a what-if scenario at the level of integrity, accuracy, and speed that you have today. I remember when I was doing my computer science thesis, I was simulating electrical engineering failure, and I was using Markov chains to do that. And it was taking me one night to simulate if there is an electrical network that one leg is broken, right? What is the cross impact in the rest of the network, the stress in the rest of the network, et cetera. That whole operation, that scenario was taking 1-2 days of simulation, right? With many minimum data points, just because we didn't have enough computing capability and we didn't have enough memory and so forth. Now that takes a fraction of a second, And your ability to take a better decision, just because you say, okay, can you tell me if I were to do that? If I were to do that, and having the depth of the root cause analysis across the pathway, I think to me, thinking and simulation will determine the next wave of innovation.
I love these cross-domain discussions because they bring entirely new ways of thinking about a problem to that problem. Now, in healthcare, in the research I do, for example, we've been using large language models to essentially query a database. We're then disappointed when the large language model hallucinates some or part of the answer, which is essentially what they do. It's a feature, not a bug, right? But in reality, he suggests that this is not the best way to leverage that technology at all. Rather than what we're currently doing, we should be using the large language models to help simulate outcomes in multiple different scenarios to identify the best possible solution given the data or the problem we're faced with, rather than looking at the problem through the lens of finding the data to support a specific solution we may have in mind, which is shaped by the way we query the database in the large language model.
We didn't launch any product that is supposed to take over or contradict the human. We actually called it Copilot. And the reason why we call it Copilot, because you're still the pilot. So in my case, I just see it from my work. I'm now 10 times more productive just utilizing AI Assist. Whether that means assisting me in writing code faster, right? Write a quick short for me and put it in, create a table for me, whatever, right? Do a simulation and let me shape my thinking. And there is this beautiful, I'll send it to you. There is this beautiful image at Microsoft that it says the following, right? Without AI, our draft quality is average. You only know what you know. With AI, our draft quality is good, primarily because you can get inspiration and data inputs from AI, right, that it can make your initial draft thesis, right, a lot better, a lot more data-driven and so forth. What is also interesting is your final quality without AI is very good, but with AI is outstanding. I've seen a very symbiotic sort of relationship between artificial intelligence technology and domain relevance.
We followed this discussion with a few questions about nuance, which is Microsoft's Ambient Scribe solution, as well as the cost of building other institution-specific large models in healthcare. It turns out that this is not inexpensive, and therefore there has to be a clear value proposition to investments like this for what are notoriously cash-strapped organizations?
I love this question, right? I think the biggest question we need to ask during those kind of situations is the value realization. And now I tell you that from tomorrow, you don't have to type anything. You can have this zero trust framework that you can log in any device passwordless and still be secure. You can get access to your data no matter where you are. And now you can simulate this data anywhere you are. And you start portraying the value realization of the impact of that activity versus the previous one. I think the business case is positive. And I'm working with some hospitals, obviously I cannot say, but I'm working with some hospitals that their thesis and their analysis on automation, productivity, and accuracy in everything that they do supersedes any cost expenditure they will do on the Azure or on the services side. I love what you said. A lot of times we think about the dollar value we're going to save. We rarely think about the people. And I think, especially when you have good talent, your biggest problem is not cost. Your biggest problem is maintaining that talent. Therefore, in my humble view, the number one requirement C-level should have, especially pertaining to good talent, is number one is how we keep them. Then how do we save money?
Next, we tackle the question of change management. As a company selling technology solutions in healthcare, what has you learned? What does it take to have a successful digital transformation?
Adoption and change management is one of the biggest topics we have in digital transformation, right? A lot of projects failed just because adoption and change management was not. Like you're moving from a non-cloud infrastructure to a cloud infrastructure, yeah. You have to move your processes, right? You move from IT to type of processes to cloud operating model and so forth. So I think with that in mind, definitely user interface helps on adoption. Obviously, you make it hard, people won't use it. If it is easy, I'll try it. If it adds value to me, I'll use it. So I think user interface is definitely one. But as we evolve as a digital institution or a digital organization, our processes need to be rethinked. A lot of times, and I see it very often, a lot of times we take something which is new and we try to make it fit something that is old, right? And it takes guts, right, from the executive team to say, you know what, the processes we had are actually archaic or they're actually not fit for digital momentum, right? And instead of maintaining and try to force fit a digital design to fit an archaic process, we actually change the process. And it takes a lot of guts, right? Because process and change management is complex.
I wanted to get into how Microsoft is embracing AI in its offerings, particularly the Copilot piece. So let's hear what Diomedes had to say.
We have, I would say, four manifestations of Copilot adoption. Four, right? Number one is use what comes out of the box. That's the easiest one, right? In the case of Microsoft, open your Office 365, right? M365, your Word, your PowerPoint, and so forth. And you can immediately experience what Copilot could look like. And that's the easiest, I would say, is the most risk-averse, just because it's pre-integrated in your software that you're using. For instance, you're using Teams, right? And now you just want to do a summarization. And that's the easiest way for you to explore the power of AI-assisted work next to you, right? The second one is what we call Enterprise GPT. I contextualize that GPT with my own reality. And this is where now privacy, risk, containment, guardrails, and so forth really fits into the place, because it's not anymore a guardrail service that is being provided to me. I actually now need to have a little understanding how I will use my data, what data should I use, how do I do data classification. A lot of times, those type of projects, they are stuck into the fact that I don't have a data strategy. And it's not about the functionality itself. It's just because, and I have many recent examples, people said, oh, I want to do Enterprise GPT. I said, okay, but you cannot use that data. Okay, and then I asked them, okay, how can I recognize this data is this data? And they said to me, oh, they don't have it governed, they don't have it classified, they don't have it tagged, they don't have it transparent and so forth, right? So before you actually start that process of Enterprise GPT, right, you actually need to have a data foundation that is actually able to cater for a requirement of GPT at the quality, transparency, and privacy that you require. Now, the third one actually contextualizes to your data. For example, it could be an enterprise search, right? So I could say, okay, at Microsoft, I could say, okay, can you give me what's the difference between AKS with this type of clustering versus that type of clustering, right? And it would say, oh, by the way, you should do that. Now, the third and fourth manifestation of evolution pertains to the fact that you becoming now a very sophisticated enterprise, and you actually want to harness in a deeper way the understanding and the knowledge that you have as an enterprise, right? Because remember, this whole LLM, this whole next generation AI is all about knowledge management, right? You're moving away from data to knowledge. And it's very different. It's not anymore a discrete table pointing to another table. It's knowledge being synthesized as an ontology. So it's a very different sort of concept altogether, right? Okay, could it be expensive? Yeah, it could be expensive. Obviously, you need a lot of training and so forth. That could cost money. But the outcome of that is your ability, right, to really get into this knowledge space like no one else. So I believe a company with that capability versus a company without this capability at the same sector, the first company has a lot of advantage in simulation, in what-if analysis, in root cause analysis, in predictive models, and so forth, which are ingrained with the type of company that it is. So.
To summarize, Microsoft packages most of their AI offerings with this concept of a co-pilot. The power of the co-pilot is directly related to the quality of the data it has to work with. The simplest version is embedded in the software platform itself, like Excel, and can help you with your spreadsheets. But the next level up, you get to Enterprise GPT, which would allow you to mine the data in the organization you run. The caveat here is that while many companies have loads of data, that data tends to be poorly managed and not accessible, and therefore not particularly useful. Now, if you spend a lot of time with IT folks, you'll hear a lot of discussions these days about data governance, accessibility, and transparency, which are all related to how to make data useful to an AI platform. So the next level up happens when the AI can make sense of the data, rather than just collect the data for a human to make sense of. Simply put, rather than create a chart of the infection rate in your hospital, it would explain that chart to you and even simulate possible outcomes if specific processes already available in your hospital were to be optimized. Now, that information is the knowledge that is buried in the data. And Dimedes then argues that while expensive to streamline your data so that it can be accessed in such a way, and providing access to institutional knowledge at one's fingertips, that will one day be mission critical to success. And then industry and hospitals and pretty much everybody will eventually have to make that transition, or at least start to collect their data prospectively in a much more AI-friendly way. But those three ideas, there's a fourth element he mentioned. Let's get back into that.
The fourth is, I would say your example could be a very narrow model for a patient in this particular practice, for this particular genetics, for this particular ethnicity, for this particular race, right? It's very narrow, right? Even for this particular user. The ability for you to digitally represent that person as a digital twin of himself, and the ability for you to simulate, no matter what happens with everybody else, just for this person, that to me is quite difficult, but quite relevant as well.
Another idea that was coming up and required a little exploration and clarification was around what Dimedes meant when he was referencing knowledge. Let's hear what he has to say.
I would say, okay, knowledge is being represented in a much more loose way, right, than data, right? Because knowledge has a multimodal, and it could have multimodal indirect impact between knowledge items, right? KI is what we call, right? So a knowledge item over time evolves. So for example, today, I didn't know you yesterday. Now I know you. And the fact that I know you has enriched my perspective about you as a kid. You can see that the relationships of that knowledge item that are being created are first of all dynamic, for zero, are dynamic, are evolving, are not static, right? Like this table and this table are associated. Right now you have this dynamic element, right? That is being morphing, right? Depending on the input that it is receiving, and is being evolving on its own, right? Depending on it learns. So I think that is very different from a data type. It's a lot more complex than just say, okay, I'm just linked to that table, right? And by the way, it has many manifestations, right? You can say, okay, friend, colleague, right? At the same arrow, friend, colleague, a professional, and all that. And within that, you have other connections too, right? So knowledge is a lot more complex, more multidimensional than just direction.
Okay, I find this both interesting and very confusing. What is interesting is the idea that knowledge can be represented as the relationships that exist between discrete data points in a set or multiple sets of data. Think of a bunch of points scattered and suspended inside a box, then having each point have an arrow that connects it to any other point it has a relationship with. and imagine that the size of the arrow matches the strength of the relationship. So let's say this box had 4 points, and each point were a person, for example, Samantha, Tomas, Ben, and Catherine. So Sam and Tom are married, and Ben and Catherine are friends, and they all have kids in the same school. So how would you represent that? Sam and Tom would have the strongest and thickest arrow because they're married. Ben and Catherine would have a smaller one, but still a pretty strong one because they're friends. And each of them have a relatively weak arrow that connects them through the school. And the school would be a fifth point as well. So data would be each data point, right? The data itself. Knowledge is understanding how those data points are related to each other and how they might interact. I guess how they might interact is the most important aspect of that. Hopefully that's helpful. Hopefully it's accurate. I think it is.
That knowledge management, right? So knowledge mining is one practice, right? We offer it also in Microsoft, but it's a practice that has recently, the past few years, really picked up. Primarily because, remember, a lot of times might not have the data to support something, but I still have the knowledge. So I might not have be able to pinpoint, okay, A plus B plus equals C, but I empirically know that this actually happens. And that's the big shift of a data-driven service, right, versus a knowledge-based service. For example, I can teach you chess by telling you how it's played, or I can teach you chess by showing you a lot of examples of chess play. One is data, right? I can show you if you move this pawn from here to here, is this. But if I describe to you, it's knowledge, right? So it's knowledge mining. So it's very different. And remember, you go now to industrial company and you have all those guys in industrial company, right? You go to a manufacturing company, whatever. They don't have not maintained data, but they have these amazing guys that are sitting at the corner of a room that have all the knowledge about something you work. How do you capture that knowledge? And it's not data. It's knowledge. It's very different. But it's not just capturing. It's also interacting with it. How you validate a knowledge item? How you validate the relationships? How do you validate that it actually exists or doesn't exist, or it needs to connect with this other stuff, right? So that whole thing together, interactivity, capturing, is all called knowledge management. Knowledge mining and knowledge management. It's a practice, right?
Okay, so here we're adding a whole other layer of complexity, right? So we started with the idea of a data set, and that by understanding the relationship between data points, we can create knowledge. And then the idea that we can use that knowledge to simulate scenarios and predict outcomes. Very cool. But what Diomedes adds here is the idea that sometimes we have knowledge without data. The example is someone who has learned over time how things work, but has no data to prove it, yet his knowledge is accurate. So how do you capture that? How do you validate it? It's a very complicated stuff, but good to understand. It provides us insights into where AI is going and how it will provide value to organizations that can leverage these tools through excellent data governance. All right, see, I brought that back. Cool. Okay, next, let's talk to Diomedes about his goals and aspirations and what he's excited about.
So currently, obviously, my passion is technology, right? Technology for a cause, let's call it. Currently, I'm acting as a CTO of Microsoft in this region, Asia Pacific. Obviously, spending a lot of time with amazing customers, learning about the industry, how technology can solve their problems. I've been very active in startups world. I had my own startup. I'm advising a lot of startups, boarding a few of them. And I'm always passionate, right, about how can next generation thinking apply to our business and transform it, whether it's medicine, whether it's finance, whether it's telco, whatever, right? And it boils down to this, right? I just feel that ultimately innovation is simple and we tend to make it complicated. But if you really think about how innovation evolves, it goes always to basic things, communication, understanding, knowledge. And I think it's very hard in a very complicated world to what I call invent and simplify. But I think when you master that, you can master innovation. Right. And commercialization is hard. But itself, I mean, I would say there is this William Olet at MIT. It says innovation equals invention times commercialization, which I think is great, right? Because invention sometimes is simple. Commercialization might be hard. Yeah, but I think ultimately, right, if you look at everything that happens today, it's actually simple things. If you look at this whole LLM thing, right, natural understanding, it's hard to implement, to your point, right? But the concept on itself is asking somebody to do and be able to understand it as if it was a human, right, or even more than human.
The concept is simple.
Or quantum. Quantum is now getting really interesting, right? But the physics of it exists since 1700. Or some of the most amazing AI models today exist because of Fermi and Euler. There are concepts which exist, but we only now are able to understand their impact and their ability just because we simplify. And that's why now I think we will see the next S-curve. We're still experiencing the value of mathematics that has been developed in the 18th century. And we are only now experiencing their benefit. I think now with the computing capability, right, we will be able to recreate the next set of capabilities that it will take us in the next S-curve, right? Because we're still in this, in my view, we're still scratching the surface of the first S-curve.
Now, Diomedes is half Greek and half French, and he grew up in Greece. He graduated from MIT in Boston, where he specialized early on in artificial intelligence. And then he went into the entrepreneurial space and had a couple of exits, one in the healthcare space and one in the IT sector, before joining Microsoft in Asia Pacific region. So I asked him about what drew him to this part of the world and actually why he stayed.
Yeah, 4 years now. 4 years with Microsoft, trying to transform. Interesting about this region, I tend to represent this the evolution of connectivities. A lot of mature industries or mature countries or mature regions, right? They went from 1G to 2G to 3G to 4G to 5G, right? Here, they went from 3G to 5G, right? Or 2G right. to 5G, right? So I think this region allows you to see those jumps of technology and capabilities that is not easy to observe somewhere else. Look at China with payments. Nobody would expect that somebody who was completely physical will do now everything digital, like there's no physical at all. So WeChat and all that, or ideas like Grab and things like that. So I think this region has the benefit of something that used to be liability, which is population, right? Large populations, now it's not a liability anymore. It's like an advantage in terms of reach, adoption, audience, and so forth. It has a lot of ingenuity, obviously, because they try to solve problems for large populations. I think it's just phenomenal, right? Yeah. Asia Pacific, I think it's obviously has a lot of diversity. You can see all the palettes of diversity, right? From really extreme low adopters to like highly penetrated adopters in terms of technology or even business modeling and so forth, right? Obviously, a lot of the things in Asia is like a little bit 80-20 type of rule, right? You have this 20% that is really forward. You have the rest of 80% that it needs to adopt. Again, it's not really a fixed rule, but you have a lot of new economies, like especially Southeast Asia, that they are very aggressive or aggressive in terms of dynamic. They want to do stuff, but recent maturity is not necessarily 100% there. They're getting there, they're discovering a lot of stuff, but it's very exciting because they are open to do anything in order for them to jump these steps and move forward. There is a little bit of, so if you look at Singapore, quite sophisticated industrial country, very thought leading in terms of even legislation and so forth. So you have this diversity of different economies and different cultures into the mix. I think it's a great area because primarily because I think population is huge, right? Every country is like 100 million. I'm from Greece, 10, right? It's like a city here. You have Jakarta, is, I don't know, 15 million people, right? I'm just Jakarta alone, right? Indonesia is 400 or something, right? It's like Philippines, like 100 and something, right? Thailand is big, et cetera, et cetera. So I think you're getting that mix, but at the same time, you're getting the openness to experiment, which I think is great. And I found that in US, when I was in US, the one thing I loved about US is people will not ask you, has somebody else do it in the context of, oh, if nobody has done it, I don't want to do it. They will ask you that question because they want to be first. And I think that is something I really love about US, the ability, especially in Silicon Valley, right? Has anybody else done it? No, okay, let's do it. If somebody is, okay, maybe we should not do it, right? But I start seeing this more and more here in Asia Pacific, where people will say, okay, let me be the first, which I think is great.
Next, I did want to bring him back to healthcare a little bit so we can hear more about his perception of how healthcare and technology are evolving contemporaneously in Southeast Asia.
It depends. You know, as I said, there are quite sophisticated countries in or regions in APAC, like Singapore, right? They have an electronic health record, right? And then data is paramount security. They do a lot of work in security of data, governance, and so forth. There are other countries who are adopting that and they're getting there. But I think in most of APAC, especially ASEAN as well, it's top of their mind. If you look up, I was looking, it was this year or last year, there was the conference, APEC conference, mm-hmm. right? Where digitalization is always top of mind. It's top thing and a lot of people were presenting and ideas around it. So I think it's top of mind for them, right? Especially with the amount of population, right, you don't have technology helping you, right, to manage. What I realized, not just in Asia, right, what I realized is when you have government-assisted frameworks, it really helps. It really accelerates, right? Obviously, it doesn't mean if you don't have one, you as a private enterprise, you cannot do it. But what tends to happen is economies really grow where you have a stable government framework that it can really assist and maintain parity. So for example, if today there is a law saying, you know what, all records need to be digital, all devices need to be passwordless, you need to embrace that. I think adoption and acceleration of that model is a lot better, a lot faster. And it's not just in medical healthcare, right? It could be sustainability, right? If a government says, you know what, green index, right? You show a green index of X, you get 2% cut, more people in tax or whatever, benefit or whatever, right? A lot of people will execute, right? Or it can be, okay, you need to do that, right? And then they will do it. I think governmental policy really helps. In general, policy really helps. I spend a lot of time in telco. One thing I notice is the one thing that gets everything working on a mobile phone is because the policy is very strong. Like 5G needs to work and this is the protocol to do it and you guys go do it, right? And of course, it comes out of discussions and so forth. But as long as you have clarity in the policy framework, in the standardization and so forth, it really accelerates adoption and execution.
Okay, and lastly, I wanted to get into the leadership questions. He addressed it a little bit when he was talking about the importance of government intervention to set the stage for digital innovation or other large infrastructure type projects. But I was curious more on the one-to-one at the company level. How does he feel about what drives digital transformation?
Okay, there are two questions into this, right? One is what ensures a successful transformation, which is, to your point, right, a lot of maybe leadership-assisted push, right? Where, because if you have a C-level that doesn't believe in transformation, it's very hard for the transformation to happen because there is no doubt you will hit roadblocks, right? And in those crucial times, you need this uplift where people will say, you know what, I got this, don't worry about it, move on. But I think for a successful leader, right, and again, I will reference Professor Venkat from Boston University, right? He wrote this book, Digital Matrix. And I think he has put it beautifully in this book. He says, digital transformation has three stages. And usually the stage that it fails is the second one. So the first phase is what he calls experimentation at the edge. This is where you have this enterprise that they have created some innovation units that they tend to get a lot of nice experiments that they could really inspire and drive momentum. Those experiments at some point become successful and they become quite relatively large. And this is where the second layer comes, which is collision at the core. Sometimes those experiments really conflict with your core capabilities. I'll give you an example, right? We at Microsoft, we used to be very transactional. And our hit refresh moment of Satya was, how do we become more subscription-based and so forth, right? We changed our entire business model. And that business model, of course, has a collision because all of a sudden you're faced with your existing business model and a new business model. A lot of companies, and this is what Professor Venkat says, is that a lot of companies fail that collision in the sense that the existing capability is really pushing back everything, right? They say, look, I've been doing this for so long. It's the cash cow. I will keep doing that. I don't care about anything else. Collision at the core. He says that successful companies are the ones who are able to overcome that collision at the core and institutionalize the new as the new core. And this is where, and I think it's beautifully the way he has said, the third wave is reinvention at the root. So it starts from experimentation at the edge to collision at the core, reinvention at the root. So I think it's beautifully, and the companies that really are successful are the ones who reinvent the root.
And there we have it. An interview with Diomedes Castanis about the future directions of artificial intelligence at scale, the rate of digital transformation in Southeast Asia, and leadership lessons he has seen play out around digital adoption. We became familiar with some highly technical jargon and at the same time had a lovely midday tea in Singapore. I hope this conversation opened your eyes just a little to the extraordinary pace of innovation in the Asia-Pacific region, as seen through the eyes of Diomedes and as experienced by me personally as I traveled in that space. Many thanks to him for generously sharing his time and ideas with us, and I can't wait to introduce you to our next guest. Until then, I hope you draw inspiration from Diomedes and change something for the better. Take care. Hey there, this is Stefano again, and I'm excited to share this new podcast. I traveled the world on my sabbatical, and I was meeting healthcare innovators with incredible stories, and I just want to share them. So let's connect. I want to hear your thoughts. DM me on LinkedIn, and I'll reply to every message. And if you like these conversations as much as I did, share the podcast. Give it a like. Your support will help spread these inspiring stories to even more people. Thank you.